I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives.
Hey everybody, I'm Zale Mednick and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. Jihad is a term that likely evokes negative emotions and thoughts for most people who hear it. When people hear the word, they likely think of terrorism, extremism, and utter disdain for the West. But what exactly is jihad? What are its true origins? Is jihadist philosophy truly violent in its original sense, or is it rather a more peaceful concept that has been politicized and weaponized, taken to the extreme as a justification for terrorism and hate? What is the role of jihad, if any, in typical Islam doctrine, and how can peaceful Islam be reconciled with these more extreme ideologies? Glennie Robinson is resident fellow in the Center of Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey. He retired in December 2021 as a professor of defense analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School following a 30-year career in the faculty. Robinson is also affiliated with the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of California at Berkeley. He's authored or co-authored 4 books on Middle East politics, as well as over 150 journal articles, book chapters, government reports, and conference papers. His most recent book, Global Jihad, A Brief History, was named by both Foreign Affairs and Foreign Policy as a best book of 2021. He's won awards for his teaching at both Berkeley and NPS. He's been active in policy work, especially for USAID and DOD, and in his professional work for the Middle East Studies Association and for the Association for Gulf and Arabian Peninsula Studies. All right, Glenn Robinson, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much.
So we're talking about jihad today, and I mentioned in the introduction, when you hear jihad, it usually is not a positive association. You're usually thinking about terrorism and violence and extremism. I'm curious, before we get into the modern way we look at jihad, what is the origins of jihad in its purest sense?
So, I mean, jihad, both then and now, has a multiplicity of meanings, both secular and religious. So just in general, and in my experience in the Arabic-speaking world, the secular use of the word jihad, which comes from the verb jahada, which means to make a struggle. I mean, something that's hard to do, you put in a big effort to do it, you know, to pass your exams or, you know, beat some number one seed on the football pitch or whatever. That gets used a lot. So the notion of making that strenuous effort in a good way. In the religious sense, it has two meanings. One, which is usually referred to as the jihad an-nafs, so the personal betterment jihad. That is being a better man, better husband, better father, better citizen, that sort of thing. Overcoming your demons to live a good, righteous, pious life. So that's a very common usage of the word in a religious sense. And then the other religious sense is the jihad as-saif, which is the jihad of the sword, which is religiously sanctioned violence in defense of Islam, defense of Muslim lives, Muslim territory, that sort of thing. And I just want to stress for your listeners that all three of these meanings are, you know, to a Muslim's ear, a very positive thing. There's no sort of contention in any of those, because they're all considered, you know, good things, whether you're being a better person, you know, putting in a good effort for something, or defending the faith against attack. All of those things have a very positive connotation.
So the betterment and overcoming your demons, that personal aspect, I think a lot of people, I don't want to say could relate to, because people aren't typically using the word jihad, but that sounds like a very good thing. It sounds like in many cultures, in many religions, there's an emphasis on self-embetterment, self-empowerment, and self-exploration and discovery. What surprises me there is when you say jihad of the sword there, how religiously sanctioned violence. What surprises me about that aspect is that most Muslims would say that's a good thing, kind of in the same vein as that self-embetterment or self-empowerment. Maybe I'm misinterpreting that, but because that obviously endorsing violence.
Well, but again, put it in historical context, in both the Christian and the Muslim traditions, there's evolved what is usually called a just war theory. So under what circumstances can you have religiously sanctioned violence, have a war that is conducted in both the decision to go to war and then the actions within the war are conducted in a way that are consistent with the tenets of the faith. So both religious traditions, again, Christianity and Islam, have developed over many centuries this kind of just war theory that are frankly quite similar to each other. And that is, if there's going to be a war, how should it come about? In other words, who gets to decide? And then the actions within the war, you know, what are legitimate, what are illegitimate? And again, both of those traditions have a very robust history in kind of working out those issues.
Absolutely. And when you think about the Crusades, obviously, that's the first example that comes to mind in terms of Christianity and kind of defending the faith and using Christianity as a reason for engaging in all those Crusade wars.
Absolutely. And one thing as well is, the people that I write about in my book on global jihad they're putting aside this tradition and sort of winging it. They're doing it on their own and have brought unto themselves the sort of self-appointed authority to declare jihad, et cetera, which they don't have that authority to do. So the folks that I'm looking at in my book are all using this violence in an illicit way, because it is not a jihad that has been properly declared by religious authority.
Maybe I was surprised, because it feels like an antiquated notion. And that's not to say that Christians today don't do that, or people of all faiths don't do that, because around the world, it's absolutely not just Islam. There are a lot of people who will wage war in the name of religion or in the name of their faith. But in the Western world now, it doesn't seem naturally like something that's accepted. War is not necessarily as common as it used to be at all, let alone for it doesn't feel that way right now, because there's so much war going on in the world, but relatively compared to history of the past couple millennia, it's not as common. It doesn't feel like religious wars are as common, though.
Yeah, it does happen. So, I mean, that, there's no denying that reality. The interesting thing on this point is there's almost always really bad blood between violent jihadis today. Not all of them. I mean, the local jihadis, there are exceptions. But in terms of the global jihadis, Osama bin Laden, ISIS, these folks, there's almost always seriously bad blood between the jihadi ideologues and the establishment clergy around the Muslim world. And just to give you one example, you recall back, what's it been, about 8 years ago, that Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi proclaimed himself to be the new caliph, right? There hadn't been a caliph in the Muslim world since the Turkish parliament abolished it in the 1920s. And so he proclaimed himself to be the new caliph, and he called on all Muslims in the world to, or at least all Sunni Muslims in the world, to recognize him as the new caliph. If you look at the number of kind of high-ranking religious scholars around the world that recognized him, that said, yes, I accept you as the new caliph, that number was zero. I mean, not at all. And again, the sort of bad blood. I mean, I go back to Osama bin Laden and the sort of bad blood between him. And there's all this kind of written correspondence that's interesting between him and the Mufti of Saudi Arabia, who's one of the top ranking clerics in the Muslim world. There was no love lost at all there. I mean, bin Laden accused him of basically sleeping on the job, of letting the Saudi royal family do all this anti-Islamic stuff and not defending the true faith. So the jihadis today, that particularly at the global level, that engage in violence are typically way outside the mainstream and are not accepted as legitimate by a lot of folks, including ranking members of the clergy.
So when you mentioned before that a lot of the different types of jihad are embraced by a lot of Muslims, the non-extremist Muslim, for example, I know the terminology is challenging and it's obviously not meant to sound offensive, but somebody who does not necessarily identify as an extremist jihad, would they look at the concept of jihad from the self-empowerment standpoint, but not look at it from that violent standpoint in that same degree?
And again, the key here is who has the legitimate authority to declare an armed jihad? So the personal betterment, nobody argues against that. That is, you know, widely accepted as a legitimate part of Islam. In terms of the jihad of sayf, the jihad of the sword, the critical issue is, you know, the process. Who gets to declare the jihad? I can't do that. You can't do that. And, you know, some random fellow on the street corner can't do that. I mean, you can do it. You can say, okay, I declare jihad, but nobody will listen or nobody should listen. So it's legitimate authority. In other words, high-ranking members, top members of the religious establishment that are in the position that can say, okay, this is a jihad, as opposed to whatever you declared, which is not, we don't consider it a jihad. So again, one modern example, in the 1980s, after the Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan in late 1979, that resistance in Afghanistan and the call for volunteers to come fight alongside the, you know, the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, that was widely viewed as a kind of an old-fashioned legitimate jihadist site, jihad of the sword. And you would have clerics around the Muslim world saying, you know, yes, that's a legitimate jihad. If you want to go fight or provide, you know, resources to that resistance, please do so. That is, you know, perfectly consistent with Islam. So it has to do with the process and who has the legitimate authority to declare an armed jihad in what circumstance.
And in that example, or any modern example, what would kind of the rationale be for saying, yeah, we are sanctioning a jihad of the sword? What would be the rationale for that? You said obviously defending the faith, but for most people in the modern world, at least in Western societies, it would be hard to see a situation where you could really get behind that and say, yep, this is sanctioned, I'm going to follow suit.
Yeah, so this is a great question. In the case of Afghanistan and similar sorts of events, here you have an armed invasion by a non-Muslim power that is killing Muslims and taking Muslim lands. So that's a very clear-cut rationale for declaring, again, sort of an old-fashioned armed jihad to push them back and to push them out. One of the interesting things about sort of modern radical jihadis, and again, I'm, you know, my book is on the global types, not the local types so much. But one of the interesting arguments that they make, and this comes straight out of Leon Trotsky and the Leninist doctrine, that jihad, armed jihad, needs to be understood as a permanent revolution, not as an episodic event, which is the traditional way to understand it. In other words, there's a call for jihad. There's, you know, an event happens. There's a call for jihad to push back the foreign invader. There's a beginning, there's a middle, there's an end. And at the end, the jihad is over. Modern radicals take the view that jihad is a state of nature. It's a permanent state. There is no beginning or end. It is from now until the end of time that an armed jihad must be done. The first guy that sort of made that argument was Sayyid Qutb, this Egyptian who was hanged in Egypt in 1966, you know, for his jihadism. He didn't give a good explanation as to kind of why we should understand this kind of radical new interpretation of jihad in this way. But other later ideologues have done so. You know, the fellow by the name of Abdullah Azam kind of gave the clearest rationale as to why jihad, armed jihad, needs to be a permanent state of affairs. And it had to do with the sort of witnessing the awe-inspiring power of God, they would refer to as Tawheed, the unity of God. And only through armed jihad can Muslims experience that. So that was his sort of in brief explanation as to why armed jihad needs to be a permanent state of affairs instead of a periodic state of affairs.
I mean, that's a dangerous mindset.
Oh, absolutely it is.
Christianity, we know, does justify, and again, there's levels of extremism for everything, but Christianity does preach conversion in many of its branches. Is jihad, or even Islam at its core, does it have the same tenet that the idea is to convert people, or the idea is that people who are not following Allah the same way people are not following God in the Christian sense are doing wrong, and that it is an imperative? Is that part of the philosophy here?
Yes. And that is, Christianity and Islam are the only two major religions in the world that for whom proselytizing is a core tenet, as a cornerstone. So save the souls. And interestingly enough, in the Muslim tradition, in the early centuries, again, this hasn't been around for a number of centuries now, but in the kind of the expansionist era of Islam, there was this sort of thing that was called missionary jihad, or sort of understood as missionary jihad. Excuse me. And that is the importance of saving souls, of actually undertaking offensive jihad to conquer a territory in order to allow the people there to experience Islam and accept Islam and have their souls saved for all time. And this is kind of, I mean, today is viewed as a very old-fashioned kind of thing, and it doesn't happen in today's world. But historically, you can point to that, yeah.
What would your non-extreme Muslim, so to speak, say about this idea of permanent revolution, this state of nature, or this idea of violence? Do most Muslims around the world, when they see what's going on with terrorism, especially in the Middle East, in the West, what would that reaction be? And it's tough to paint a broad brush over anybody, but would most Muslims say, wow, I mean, this idea of jihad by the sword is extreme and there really is no place for that?
Yeah, you know, you don't have to take my word for it. We actually have polling data from around the Muslim world that shows very clearly what Muslims have view about all sorts of things. And in general, these sort of global jihadi extremists, you know, the 9/11 kind of actions, or the hotel bombings in Jordan was another example about, I think, 17 years ago, that were the support for the folks that did that or advocated.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Those things, it was in the single digits in almost every case. So it is not, you know, again, the radical kind of interpretation of Islam, permanent jihad, permanent armed jihad, that is not widely accepted amongst Muslims. It's just, it's a very radical notion that, you know, a few hardcore believers accept, but most Muslims reject.
And that's what I would have assumed, but it's such an important point, because we obviously have a world where there's a lot of Islamophobia, there's a lot of anti-Semitism, there's a lot of hate of multiple religions. I mean, I'm thinking obviously right now about the war in Israel and Gaza, but it's important to kind of differentiate those notions, that it's easy to say a lot of Muslims believe in this violent jihad, but that's a very, very, very important statistic that is not the case, and that kind of jihadist violent belief does exist and is a serious problem, but that is not reflective of the Muslim community at large.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
What is the origins of jihad, violent jihad, in the Quran, if all? Does the Quran call for this kind of violence? Because there are some elements in a lot of religions where you look at the source readings where you're like, wow, this is pretty extreme. I mean, there's stuff in the Old Testament that you look at and you say, wow, this is extreme stuff. And I look at very Orthodox people and I think, wow, I don't know how you believe this, but I also understand that from your perspective, you're just following the text. Is, in the perspective of the extremist violent jihadist, are they finding texts that actually do call for this, or is this a gross extrapolation which is been misused?
So two responses. First is, because you brought up Israel and Gaza and what's going on there, it's important to remember that the sort of, you know, national liberation jihads, I mean, jihadi groups and others who are trying to, in their own minds, liberate a patch of land somewhere. So Hamas with Palestine, Hezbollah during the period where Israel was occupying southern Lebanon, groups in Kashmir and Indian-controlled Kashmir, to some degree in Mindanao in the southern Philippines. There are a few places out there, and Palestine would be the most important one, that the cause is, first of all, it's not some global jihadi kind of thing. It is seen as a righteous cause and has significant popular approval. Now, what Hamas did, the methods that it did on October 7th, that has actually generated a fair amount of, at least in the early first couple of weeks, a fair amount of argumentation within the Muslim world, because, you know, sort of this horrific violence against civilians is very clearly against the sort of Islamic just war theory. You know, you're not supposed to kill women and children and, you know, brutalize them and all that sort of thing. So there was actually a fairly significant debate. That debate has gone down as the sort of carnage in Gaza has continued, and people are focusing on that. So that's the first point. The second point is, yes, jihad has been around. It's you find the word in the Quran on several occasions. The concept has been around from the beginning of Islam. It has developed, the meanings have developed, the sorts of jihad we're talking about that we spoke about earlier, you know, that's developed over time. And just to give you one example, a person who dies in pursuit of a legitimate armed jihad, we know them as a martyr. In Arabic, that is shahid, shuhada, in its plural. Shahid in its origin, and still to this day, literally means witness, someone who witnesses for the faith. The proclamation of the faith, which is sort of the first pillar of Islam, to say there's no God but God and Muhammad is the main prophet, that is known as a shahada. So same root, same word. So a shaheed is somebody who witnesses, who professes for the faith. It did not take on this notion of martyrdom, of dying, not just witnessing for the faith or professing the faith, but dying for the faith as Islam in the 7th and 8th centuries, as it interacted with Syriac Christians. So Christians in the Levant that very much had in their tradition that witnessing for the faith oftentimes meant death. So a connection between, you know, witnessing or professing the faith and dying for the faith was very, you know, very much part of that Christian tradition. And that influenced the Muslims as they expanded into the old Byzantine area. And so shaheed then at that point in time also then took on this meaning, not just witnessing for the faith, but actually dying in pursuit of a legitimate jihad. But the concept of jihad has been around really since the, again, it's evolved and stuff, but it's the basic notions has been around since the beginning.
I want to take a step back. You speak in your book about the evolution of jihad, and you describe sort of four waves and types of jihad. Are you able to briefly walk through that evolution from the 80s until present day and how you break down jihad in a very interesting way?
Sure. So I'm interested in this offshoot of the jihadi movement, which has been around, again, it's a very much a 20th century movement. But in the 1980s, you had this offshoot that said, look, our problem is not the local regime, local state, or trying to liberate a little local patch of land. Our problem is global. And this kind of thinking did not begin until the 1980s. And in the book, I say, look, there's been four very distinctive iterations, or what I call waves, of this global jihad understanding. So the first wave, again, in the 1980s, is very much connected to the Soviet invasion and occupation of Afghanistan and these waves of volunteer Muslims from around the Middle East and the broader Muslim world to help Afghans fight the Soviets. This was basically put into a larger framework by this Palestinian Jordanian by the name of Abdullah Azam. And he took this common phrase, Qaida Sulba, the cornerstone or the solid base or solid foundation term, which had been up to that point had been understood as just territory, that once we liberate Afghanistan, we will have the territory to do stuff in the broader Muslim world. And he basically came up with a new interpretation and said, no. It basically means that solid base is the development of a pious warrior class that can travel, once we're done in Afghanistan, can travel from place to place to help Muslim communities liberate occupied lands. We begin in Afghanistan. Palestine was very much next for him. But then again, you know, Kashmir, the Central Asian republics, then under Moscow's rule, Mindanao, elsewhere, where this jihadi international, kind of, it's not a translation, but they, because it's so similar to the communist international notion, this should be the kind of the global response to liberating occupied Muslim lands. That was the first wave. He gets assassinated. The kind of first real world attempt to implement this jihadi international model, and that is in Kuwait in 1990 when the Iraqis invade, was rejected by the Saudis. And that first wave kind of died. The second wave is Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden that, you know, most folks in North America are quite familiar with. Had nothing to do with occupied Muslim lands. This was about really the durability of what bin Laden viewed as apostate local regimes in the Muslim world, in the Arabian Peninsula, the Middle East, the broader Muslim world. And he took this notion that had been bouncing around for a few decades by an Egyptian by the name of Faraj. And this is the near enemy, far enemy distinction. And he basically flipped it on his head and said, look, The reason why these local apostate regimes are durable is because of the United States. It's that support that keeps these guys in power. So when we assassinate the president or, you know, whatever, when we punch them in the face, they wobble, but the regime's upright. And they do that because of the United States. So we need, for bin Laden, we need to attack the Americans and drive them out of the region. Once we do that, then these local regimes will be vulnerable. And when we punch them in the face, they will collapse and stay down. And, you know, again, there's still a few believers in that sort of second wave, but not very many. The biggest wave by far was the ISIS, the caliphate wave. This is the state building wave. So building a puritanical state right in the heart of the Middle East, very much different from liberating Muslim lands, very much different from, you know, how do we weaken local apostate regimes. This was building a state where the practice of pure Islam, again, a very fundamentalist version, can be done. So we can build a state where there is no apostasy at all, no sinful behavior, no temptations for sinful behavior. And it will expand and again, will, you know, grow the caliphate again. So they're very much a state building, radical, but and pre-Westphalian, if you want to talk about that. So not a modern state, but a state from, you know, 800 years ago. And that essentially was, again, there are some believers. ISIS is still a fairly potent terror group out there. But in 2017, they lost their territory. They lost Mosul in Iraq. They lost Raqqa in Syria. And so that territoriality, that territorial state, the thing that made them different had now gone away. So that was the third wave. The fourth wave is one that I say that we are in now, and we will probably be in for quite some time. And I talk about it as the jihad fardi, the personal jihad wave, based in part on the work of an ideologue by the name of Abu Musab al-Suri. And this is the sort of the internet wave. This is in a time of darkness from a jihadi point of view. So Suri was worried. This is, you know, after the regime in Afghanistan, the Taliban, had been overthrown in late 2001 because of its 9/11 activities. And you saw what was going on in Iraq as well. But this was kind of a time of turmoil and kind of disaster, a point of weakness. So he develops a strategy of survival, of how to live to fight another day. And this is this kind of personal jihad, what we would refer to as lone wolf attacks or small groups, small cells, that are connected on the internet and social media, that the media game is a really important part of this, to always proclaim your little attack that killed two or three people, proclaim it in the name of global jihad, of ISIS, Al-Qaeda, doesn't matter, some form of global jihad. And that way we can have a kind of a media power that suggests the actual power of our group is more than probably it really is in reality. So this is, in my mind, a very durable form of violent jihad, because you can, and I use the term stochastic terror, stochastic violence, which is a term of probability, that when calls go out for violence, you know that there will be an increase in violence. You just don't know where, you know, which person that week or that month will get in his truck and, you know, run over a bunch of pedestrians or bicyclists in the name of jihad, or hook up a, you know, little pressure cooker bomb that you read about online, such as the Boston Marathon bombers, and set that off. You don't know who's going to be radicalized so much that they're going to take that action this week. So this is this kind of networked personal jihad phase of the fourth wave of global jihad.
That's a very good summary, and it's a really interesting way that you break it down and kind of easy for people to understand at least the progression of that and the evolution of that. How big, on the one hand, this is a very obvious question, but I imagine you have a more nuanced answer. How big is this problem of jihad by the sword, this idea, as you described, of permanent revolution, state of nature? How dangerous is that? I mean, I know the answer is extremely dangerous, but when the belief being espoused is one that everybody basically who does not believe in Islam is condemned, and this idea that martyrdom in a violent form is important in the name of faith. It's a scary belief. How do you begin to negotiate with such an ideology? And how significant of a problem do you envision this being beyond what it already is in some parts of the world?
So the good news is it's a pretty marginal group of people, again, that I write about in terms of the global jihadis and this permanent revolution and armed jihad being, you know, ever present. It's a very small number of people. I don't think negotiations is something that you do under circumstances. I don't think that they are proper. But, you know, again, more good news is that pretty much everybody hates them, not just those in the West. But regimes throughout the Muslim world, you know, do their best to suppress these groups whenever they arise, and in often cases probably go too far in that regard. So it's not a popular form. So, you know, you think about Mao and, you know, fish swimming in the ocean, the need for popular support, social support. These folks don't have it. Again, global jihadis don't have that kind of support. So they tend to be few in number. And I don't think they represent a existential threat or even a major strategic threat, at least short of nuclear weapons, which is, I think, not going to happen anytime soon. But it's durable. And so I don't think you can just sort of ignore it. This is what, when the book I refer to, is a deadly nuisance. It's, again, not a big strategic threat, but it's deadly, and it will rise up to kill people from time to time. And sort of law enforcement and others need to be aware of that reality.
Because it's a marginalized group in that most people hate them. On the other hand, they do seem to wield a lot of power in the Middle East. I mean, Hamas, for example, has obviously jihadists as part of it. ISIS was jihadist. Al-Qaeda was jihadist. So while they might be marginalized, they've had a significant effect on global affairs.
So I want to, again, make that distinction, again, between global jihadis like Al-Qaeda and ISIS that are very small in number, but can be potent in their sort of deadly attitudes against a kind of local liberation groups. So Hamas does, you know, sometimes uses the word jihad. Actually, they don't use it a whole lot. But this is not a global kind of thing. So again, Hamas and Hezbollah and, you know, folks historically in Kashmir and elsewhere, they are a lot more popular in their own societies because they are seen as fighting to liberate land that, you know, kind of everybody in your society thinks was wrongly taken from you. So I don't want to put them in the same basket because they're quite different.
And that's the first wave of jihad that you were speaking of.
So the first wave of global jihad was the Afghan model. So my book is looking at these four waves of global jihad, not the jihadi phenomenon writ large. So today and basically always, there have been more local jihadis, you know, the Hamas type folks, than global jihadis, which tends to be, again, you know, they've made the news because of some, you know, big terror actions with Al-Qaeda, 9/11, for example, and everything that ISIS was doing against, you know, targeting civilians. So they, again, can be very deadly. But those types of jihadis, these global jihadis, tend to be very small in number. And again, it's a durable form of jihad, but it's not one that is, you know, short of nuclear weapons, would rise to a major strategic threat. The local jihad groups, again, that just depends on the issue, the kind of land liberation jihadi groups, of which Hamas and Hezbollah in its origins was very much representative of. They tend to be, you know, very different animal. They tend to be quite popular, not only in their own societies, but in neighboring societies as well. Why? Because their cause is seen to be just. Global jihadis' cause, different causes, of course, are not generally seen to be just.
I think one of the big challenges, I mean, without getting too much into the weeds of the war in Israel and Gaza and Hamas, because that's a massive topic, and we've done a couple episodes on Israel and Palestine. But I think one of the reasons it's such a complicated conflict is because, on the one hand, there is a cause there that a lot of people support in terms of the situation in Palestine, which many people believe has merit and believe it's an illegal occupation. On the other hand, when it's mixed with some sentiments of jihad, even if it's not global jihad, but these sentiments of what these people were saying on October 7th, and the footage of that that was done in the name of jihad, perhaps, or in the name of extremism, it's tough to reconcile those two. And there's no simple solution to that, but that's what makes the conflict very challenging for some people, because while there might be legitimate arguments there, many of those arguments are baked in with this extremist violence, and that complicates the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And so kind of 2 points on that question. One is, it's kind of interesting, Hamas, like Hezbollah, like Iran, generally does not use the word jihad. It does sometimes, but typically the word it uses is muqawama, which is resistance. So it will talk about violence in the name of muqawama, of resistance. And I think this is a way to broaden its appeal, because kind of everybody, all Palestinians, support resistance in one form or another against Israel's occupation. And maybe Israel itself, but that's a different issue. So it's just kind of the choice of vocabulary is interesting for me. Now, I think there is this sort of interesting, in what I would call an international demonstration effect by the global jihadis that has rubbed off on Hamas and maybe others as well around the world, rubbed off on these local jihad groups. And that is on the notion of violence. The sort of this kind of grotesque, over-the-top violence that you saw on October 7th, this was kind of a new thing, and the sort of the horrific thing that was done to some already dead bodies, this is a new thing. You don't have a history of that in any great length with Hamas. I think this is the ISIS effect. And in fact, in the book a little bit, but I go back to Frantz Fanon, a fellow from Martinique who was a French citizen, lived in France, dark-skinned, obviously, from Martinique in the Caribbean, and became this great spokesman for the Algerian Revolution against the French, 1954, 1962, a strong proponent of it. And he wrote about violence, and not advocating it, but saying the natural flow of anti-colonial violence is going to be horrifically personal. Right, it's killing your oppressor with your own hands, getting his blood on your own hands as a sort of purification. It's almost ritualistic. And ISIS very much was of that type. The Algerian civil war in the 1990s was the first place you saw that in a very big way. But this is before the internet was became a big thing. So we didn't have all those videos uploaded that we did with ISIS, for example. I think that kind of understanding of violence and ritualistic violence, sort of purification, grotesque violence that Fanon was the first to write about, has kind of worked its way through Algeria again, ISIS. And now I think you saw that in Hamas's action on October 7th.
Glenn, do you have any final thoughts on, in the vein of preconceptions or other big misconceptions that people might have about jihad, as some closing words?
Well, let me end on a question that I get asked all the time, and that is, which is of course a broader question, and that is Islam a religion of peace, or is Islam a religion of war and violence? And my answer is yes. Yes to both, right? I mean, it's Islam, like Christianity, like any great sort of cultural arena, is a cultural toolbox, and people can pull out different tools to build different kinds of ideologies, and they can pick and choose. And so you see with the sort of the radical interpretations of global jihad that I write about, they can pick and choose what tools out of that cultural toolbox that they want in order to construct a broader ideology that is in support of armed violence, continual armed violence. But it just depends. And again, most Muslims don't buy into that, of course, at the sort of big global level. But it really is about interpretation, not the essence of the text, but who's interpreting it and how they're interpreting it.
If you were to compare Christianity and Islam, is the essence of those texts, would you say, is the Quran, is that inherently more violent than than the New Testament, or the essence of the biblical works of the Old Testament and the New Testament? Or is it more so just that it's been interpreted in the wrong way and radicalized in one case? And I don't want to say not the other, because Christianity, of course, has its radicals, and especially in past millennia has been radicalized, but in the modern day?
Intrinsically, no, I don't. You know, again, you can build different ideologies because it's such a broad tradition, right? Islam, Christianity, and others, they're big traditions. You can build whatever you want out of those traditions. I spent a lot of time in southern Spain, Andalusia, and the sort of El Andalus historic region. And the kind of just grotesque violence that the Catholic Church visited upon Muslims and Jews in Spain in the 15th, 16th centuries. I mean, it's just grotesque. And this was institutionalized, not kind of a institutionalized power as opposed to some marginal group out there. So I don't think there's anything intrinsically different, but you can pick and choose, cherry pick the kinds of lessons from that historical cultural toolbox that you want, depending on what kind of ideology you're intent on building.
With a lot of Islamophobia going on, I think it is easy to look at Islam and say, this is just a violent religion, this is a violent culture, and Islam is the problem. But from an expert like you to say, no, I mean, people have taken things out of context, or people have picked and chosen what they want to from Islamic doctrine. So there is an extremist section of Islam, but it's not that there's an inherent problem with Islam, is very, very important in hopefully giving people a better understanding and reducing general Islamophobia, which is a very important thing as we try to combat jihad and global jihad, to understand the distinction.
Absolutely. To the degree we can reduce these sort of irrational hatreds, the better.
Well, Glenn Robinson, thank you so, so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. You should check out his book, Global Jihad, A Brief History. You can go on Amazon and you can find it. And you can just type in Glenn E. Robinson on Google, and that will take you to his website, and you can learn more about him and his work. Glenn, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
And thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of Preconceived. Have a great day.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.